Wilder Utopia. If you like what you've heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes. You have been listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350. Executive producer, myself, Jack Eit, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Executive Committee meets on the second Thursday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through our public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
This is the Progressive Page Turner. I'm Marianne Barisonic. On this program, we'll talk about books with the people who wrote them.
The idea that we could fruitfully communicate with non-humans is considered a flight of fantasy in the current industrial civilization. It's generally unquestioned that only humans are capable of creating culture. But what if the rest of the world has been trying to communicate with us and we just couldn't hear it? In their book, Nature Kind, Language, Culture, and Power Beyond the Human, Melissa Leach and James Fairhead expand the definition of communication and culture by exploring new discoveries in the biological sciences and finding syntax, symbolism, and social learning beyond the human. And my guest today is James Fairhead. James, thanks so much for talking with me.
Well, thank you so much for inviting. It's a real pleasure to be with you and to have a chance to air a few of these ideas from the book Nature Kind. Yeah.
Why is communication with the non-human world important to the survival of humanity?
Whoa, that's a big question. Well, we're all part of a planet. We share it with the rest of life, and we're all intimately entangled with life. We need to care for it. So how we relate to that wider life really matters. And sometimes we relate to it rather mechanically, thinking that the rest of life operates according to forms of instinct, and that we can use it as we please, and that we humans are something different, that we have thoughts, we make meaning, we have culture, we're so thoroughly different. That means that we create a divide between ourselves and the wider life that we're entangled with.
Does changing the way we view nature change how we treat the world we inhabit?
Well, that's a really core part of the book and the reason for writing it. Because if we consider nature through the lens that it's so entirely different from the human world, that we need biological sciences to study nature and human sciences and social sciences to study human, then we create such a divide between ourselves and wider life that it becomes very hard to interpret ourselves as part of it in a clear way. What we're trying to do in this book is to build on some of the biological sciences that are showing that it's not just humans who have culture, but that culture is a far more generic thing, that whales, chimpanzees, but also Drosophila alter their lives according to their inherited ways of being passed down generations, and that the communication between spiders or between bees uses the same principles as we do when we're speaking linguistically, like we are now. So there are signs and grammars in the ways spiders communicate. These principles that we have and have thought to be exclusively human are far wider in nature, and they help us communicate with the wider world. I'm sure many of your listeners will have private languages with their dogs, with their cats, with their horses, with the other living things around, creating private cultures with them. And to do that, well, when you think about it, why is that possible? It's possible because we share similar linguistic and communicative practices with that wider world that we're communicating with. So what we're doing in this book is teasing out these common linguistic cultural programs to show that culture isn't just a human thing, society isn't just a human thing, language isn't just a human thing, and therefore we can imagine ourselves as part of much wider communities.
There's this phrase you used, culture as a second inheritance system. Can you give me an example? And you were talking about things like spiders and fruit flies. You've actually been able to see how they have a culture that isn't just instinct?
Yes, that's what biologists are beginning to discern nowadays. I'm an anthropologist, so I study human worlds, but I've been fascinated in reading in great detail the findings of the biological revolution that is able to turn our new digital technologies and laser technologies to understand the tremulation of spiders on their webs, or the movements of bees in their hives. And one's beginning to be able to discern that one beehive is very different to the next, and that one set of killer whales in one part of the ocean lives entirely differently in terms of its feeding habits and hunting habits to other whales in other parts of the ocean. And these things are passed down generations, just like our ways of life are passed down generations, changing, of course, but nevertheless being inherited, but it being inherited not instinctually only, but as part of cultures. And that's why biologists are beginning to see the wider nature as a far more cultured thing.
There was a description of how, if you look at the dance that the bees do to tell each other where the pollen is and where the flowers are not anymore, one hive won't be able to understand the other hive. And they have to be taught this dance. And if they don't have an elder to teach it to the young ones, they won't know how to find the pollen.
Yeah, it's really fascinating what the study of bees can show us about the wider world, really. These are insects that are all around us, living in hives, and there they are showing the way to the flowers. But they don't just show the way to the flowers by just following one another. They communicate with each other in the hive to let the other bees know where the flowers are. And they have certain ways of dancing, which are called waggle dances, which show the direction and the distance that the flowers are, but in a symbolic way, not in a physical way. And the symbolism used in one hive is different to the symbolism that's used in another. There's an acquired set of meanings. But it's not just that. When the bees come back from the flowers, having discovered they're all empty of their nectar, they come back and they start headbutting the other bees that are in the hive, who are still sending bees towards those old flowers. to say, no, stop. Look, they're not. There's no point going there. You've got to find somewhere else to go. So the bees are operating according to a very sophisticated set of exchanges of meaning within the hive to alert every other bee to how to use the flowers. And that is using symbolic language, a bit like our own.
There's a lot of indigenous cultures that have traditions around interspecies communication. What are some of those, and what can we learn from them?
What we try and do in this book is probe a little of that, but also not leave it to people we categorize as indigenous to think that they can and we wider modernists can't, as it were. In a sense, we're all indigenous to the planet, we're all indigenous to life, and there is a way within which what we're trying to do here is excavate a little bit everyday encounters that we have, not just to think that this is something that we've lost, all of us, except indigenous people who've managed to hold on to it. But that said, there are very many people around the world who have very different ways of thinking about communication beyond the human than ourselves. And they're not caught up in the different disciplines that we've manufactured for ourselves, like the humanities or the social sciences or zoology or biology. So people who don't necessarily see the world through those silos and can therefore not get drawn into this distancing of themselves from wider entanglements. So I don't know, if you're a Sami herder from the northern part of Norway and Finland, then communicate, learn how to encourage reindeer to go across rivers. If you're in parts of West Africa, where Melissa and I have worked as anthropologists, we find people able to understand life in the soils and relate to those soils as living soils rather than as somehow just inert matter. And so through that attentiveness to life and what it's communicating to you, you can, as it were, communicate back and work with it rather than treat it as some mechanical substance that isn't communicative. So what we're trying to do is to excavate a bit everyone's capacity to participate in these more than human cultures and more than human languages. Your listeners, as I was indicating, surely have had close experiences with the animal world around them, around yourselves, to know that communication is something that is every day and germane to our lives with cats and dogs and in some way. I mean, look at dog agility and the ways people can help animals find their way weaving through canes, as it were.
I think we've all heard the songs of the whales and the dolphins. They seem to have a very sophisticated communication system. Do you think we'll ever get to the point where we can actually carry on a conversation with them?
There are a lot of people with that ambition, and of course, artificial intelligence is beginning to give a certain promise to the possibilities of deciphering the meanings from beyond. But there are one or two problems that we identify with the way that's going on at the moment. So there is this idea somehow that, I don't know, bees speak bees and tigers speak tiger and whales speak whale. But humans don't speak human. We speak inordinate number of languages and we have an inordinate numbers of ways of life. Indeed, you know, there are different ways of life and languages between different houses in the same street. So it's not going to be so simple as to identify what whales are saying. Sometimes we can assume that there's a sort of single language out there for every species, but that we share so many. What we're trying to get at in this book are the principles through which to understand the emergence of different languages within different species and across species, and the ways within which to understand whales in a particular place, we're going to have to understand them differently to whales in a different place. So it's not so easy to understand language in relation to particular species, but to much wider communities of whatever it is, whales or spiders or flies or whatever, but in those locations as well.
Another part of this that I thought was so interesting was the idea that in addition to what you're saying, where different animals in different parts of the world will have different languages, basically, we also have to overcome the fact that there's communication apparatus, let's say, that's very different from ours. So the way that, say, bats communicate is so different from the way that we communicate. Just overcoming that, and even plants, because apparently plants have a very sophisticated communication system, but it's very different from a human communication system.
I think that's why the biological sciences are becoming so much more exciting to study now, as we begin to see how memory and the ways plants acquire memory and pass experience down from generations to generations involves all sorts of understandings that we haven't yet begun to grasp. The science is beginning to get the techniques to probe these questions with the capacity to slow down the sounds of bats to human audible levels, or to see the different patterns of vibrations on a spider's web that digital laser technologies can now show up, that we begin to see the very, very, very different modes of communication, the sensorium of the world that is so different to our own. But then if you think about our own language, we don't just speak. We nod and we move. We wear clothes that are different, that speak different things about us. So we have a whole wide variety of, I'm going to call them languages, that are rooted in symbolic patterns, that have syntax and have different signs within fields of signs. You're wearing a certain jacket, if you were wearing a formal dress, or if you were wearing a male suit, it would mean something totally different to me right now. You know, so you can speak through all sorts of modes, not just language. And so it is with the wider world, that we're just beginning to discover all of the different intricacies that there are, both vibrational, electric, magnetic, all sorts of manners of communication that we didn't realize carried meaning, but now we can.
You're listening to The Progressive Page Turner on KBOO, your member-supported, volunteer-powered community radio station. I'm Marianne Barisonic. My guest today is James Fairhead, and we're talking about his book, Nature Kind, Language, Culture, and Power Beyond the Human.
I found it fascinating to think about plant communication, because in a lot of science fiction stories, the problem is communicating with a very different kind of civilization. And what if we have a very different kind of civilization, and it's been living with us the whole time? A lot of the plant communication is actually chemical. Is that correct?
Your question is just beautiful. And to see how science fiction has almost got where science hasn't quite caught up with in these areas is fascinating, because yes, there are ideas that somehow we've got to learn how to communicate with these extraterrestrial beings that suddenly arrive, as Hollywood films would have it. But we could spend a lot more time actually trying to work with the beings that are here on the planet and begin to tease out the systematic symbolism involved in communication that's going on.
I thought it was interesting that it's just a completely different mode of communication with the plants.
Through chemicals, indeed, and through the symbiotic relations that plants perhaps have with the mycorrhizal fungi that are growing in the earth, different modes of communication between plants. You see, plants seem to be able to recognize their own roots underground from other roots, and they can intertwine in different ways with each other and through symbiotic or close relations with other species that are moving between them. So it's a fascinating world. We try to document a little of that in the book, but also maybe in your room right next to you, you've got a house plant that's growing, or in your garden, you've got some things that you're kind of nurturing, and they're giving off signs of growing well or growing badly, and you're probably reacting to those signs and feeding them or giving them water, and they're probably reacting back, and you're feeling better from them feeling better. There's some sort of conversation going on there. Now, there's often a way within which we don't notice how entangled we are with the living world around, but a lot of people in their homes right now listening to the radio will be caring about the plants. And one part of that care isn't just looking at them, it's tending them. And part of that tending is about working with something else that's alive. And so part of our book is to tease out how that communicative relation is part of a caring relation. And it happens with plants in your house, it happens with plants in your garden, but it can happen with a lot wider life as well. So the more we see and appreciate these communicative moments we have, the more effective emotional entanglements we can realize we can have that are beyond human entanglements.
What do you mean by the phrase urban nature kind?
Let me kick off that, you know, the vast majority of people nowadays live in cities, or if they're not cities, maybe they're towns and urban places. And we're apt to think of these as somehow separate from, I don't know, the countryside or the national parks, that the nature is out there, but in the cities, it's not to be. But a lot of people around the world find ways to live in close proximity with more than human life in urban areas, maybe looking after pigeons from their rooftops, doves and homing pigeons, or tending insects in the garden walls and treasuring the fungi that's growing around. So what we're trying to do is to reveal that this communicative practice isn't just something that we need to see as somehow prevalent among peoples who haven't become part of the consumer world, but that it's prevalent in all of our lives, in urban as well as in rural areas. So we just need to pay attention a little bit to our relations with the more than human life. There's just one issue there that we can learn from indigenous peoples, and that is where life ends. You see, some people see not just trees as alive, but the forests as alive. Equally, there are spirits which are beyond our appreciation that we can communicate with, at least within many indigenous philosophies and understandings of religious practices, but not just religious, but also ecological practices. And so just what is alive, what is communicating and what isn't, we find fascinating. And yes, biological sciences have their definitions, but we humans don't operate in our everyday lives according to those definitions. And so that leaves us with some quandaries that we try and tease out in this book. But they become slightly more philosophical, but they're still quite interesting.
Do you think that once we begin to say it is possible to communicate with plants or an entire forest, that it makes it easier for us to see that or to understand that? And that if we have this attitude that it can't possibly happen, we just will never see it.
Yeah. Where we're coming from in this book is, in a sense, the biology of this communicative practice, that the biologists are beginning to show us that symbolic language isn't something that is specifically and only human, and that culture isn't something that's specifically human and only. So we'd better start worrying about why it was that we ever came to think that it was. And that is something that I'm sure a lot of your listeners will have something to think about. But a lot of writers now would see this idea of creating a nature that's somehow not like us means that we can treat it in ways that are not like us. We can be much more disrespectful. I mean, a lot of us are disrespectful of other people, but we sure are a lot of even more disrespectful of wider world around. And so what we can begin to show from this new biology is the tragedy of treating nature as if it was a sort of mechanical ecosystem that was sharing energy and light, but not meaning.
How does this fit in with the Earth Law and the rights of nature?
That's fascinating. Thank you for asking. You know, the rights of nature movement is emerging out of indigenous understandings in Bolivia, in New Zealand, among Maori people, who feel that Mother Earth is a mother and a part of kinship in some way, and therefore should have rights a bit like other of our kindred do, human rights. Now, that might seem strange, but when you also look at it, corporations have rights. They're not humans, but they have rights. And our children, they have rights, even babies who can't communicate, but they have guardians. And so there's a movement in the legal world now to find ways to enshrine what we might call human rights beyond the human. And this is a very powerful set of legal structures that might just hold us to account in our destructive practices, because nothing else seems to hold us back. So if human law can begin to embrace a wider framing of rights and legal standing, then it starts to become possible, perhaps, to find new ways to limit the destruction of life and meaningful life beyond us. It's a new legal movement that is nascent. People are finding it challenging, but actually it's very interesting.
Yeah, you know, I think that idea that you just talked about, where we've given rights to corporations, and corporations wind up being this engine of destruction because they're pathological about seeking nothing but profit. They don't have any respect for the natural world or for human rights. And we've given them all kinds of rights. And it only makes sense that we should be giving a lot of rights to things like our rivers and our forests, because that's what's the underpinning for the life support system that we depend on. So let's stop giving all these rights to death and start looking at how we can give it to life.
Your words, but absolutely. I think when you point it out, this is something that seems so obvious. How have we come to spend centuries without that appreciation? Well, part of it is to do with the way we organize our economy and prioritize humans above what we might call resources. When I was raised as a scientist, it was as a scientist of natural resources management, as if humans were humans and the rest of the world was a resource. In this book, we're trying to show that that rest of the world isn't just a flat, uncommunicative part of the planet, but it's making meaning like we are and making meaning with us. And that the more we impoverish it, the more we'll be impoverished.
And one of the things that you wrote about in the book is the way that conservation policies or the notion of rewilding can actually separate people from nature.
It goes back to your question about urban nature kind, as it were. There is a sense in which somehow there are wildernesses where you go to see the natural world and elsewhere you just abandon it, a bit like a sacrifice zone. But that way of separating ourselves from places of wilderness, places without humans, is a bit strange because, in fact, we have life all around us, if only we would see it, and it's communicative life at that. And I think the biologists more and more are revealing the sophistication of the exchange of meanings across species, which means that we don't only have to go to certain particularly special places in order to appreciate that. That said, of course, those particular places can be wonderful places to go and places to encounter and really refresh ourselves. But if you spend a few hours in a forest, you can come back feeling, oh, you visited it, you've come home. But to really learn the language of that forest, is it to develop a language with your dog or to develop ways of communication with your cat or your horse, it takes time, it takes perseverance, it takes patience. Just to go into a place and come out of it isn't quite what we're probing. We're thinking, well, if you take time to learn and to see how it is we can communicate beyond ourselves rather than just have a passing glimpse.
You've been listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest is James Fairhead, and we've been talking about his book, Nature Kind, Language, Culture, and Power Beyond the Human, that he wrote with Melissa Leach. James, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, and thank you so much for inviting me, and thank you so much to your listeners for spending a little time listening.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
You're listening to our KBOO Fights Back campaign. Help KBOO reach our $75,000 goal by December 31st so we can bring you another great year of cutting-edge radio made by you, for you. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 to contribute today.
I'm Ken Jones, host of Jonesy. No relation, by the way. Before we get started, just a reminder that we're in the second week of our KBOO Fights Back end-of-year drive. We're trying to raise $75,000 by December 31st, and we can use your help.